This is our final session for this week, and I am grateful to those of you who have been faithful attendees. And
really enjoyed it. Thank you so much. It's been a highlight.
I'm glad. I've enjoyed it too. It's really been fun for me. There are a few new faces today, so I will just, by way of brief introduction, say that I am Beth Boyens, and I live in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, where I teach in the English department at Augustana College. And this week's study on American women regionalists is a small portion of the dissertation that I'm currently working on. And so it's been fun for me to kind of try these out on you guys and get your take on things.
Is that for your doctorate?
So, yeah, so I appreciate
that.
Oh, with
four kids.
Yeah.
Oh, bless you.
Well,
I'll remember you in prayer.
Thank
that's
you.
That's a huge, that is a huge. I have a daughter working on a master's in one.
Yeah.
It's tough to do that and balance with the family. So,
yeah, pray for tenacity and
completion.
And completion would be excellent.
Yeah. You're nearing the end.
I am. I'm nearing the end, but it sort of feels like endless process, but it will come to an end at some point.
But you got your dissertation chosen and everything?
Yes, and I've had my exams.
Oh, well,
so,
cool.
Anyway, so today I've titled the talk My Place, My Story, and I want to just begin with a phrase that has become dear to me. I have it plastered on our kitchen wall, and the phrase is, home, the place my story begins. And just think, you've maybe seen that before. It's kind of printed on plaques and things like that. Home is where your story begins, or home, the place your story begins. What does that say to you? What comes to mind when you hear that phrase?
Well, it's kind of like the center of your universe, really.
Mm-hmm.
I basically feel the same way.
Yeah.
I love getting away, but it's wonderful to be home.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of like the foundation of that holds then how the rest of your story goes. If you have no, it's just like having a base from which you come,
mm-hmm.
and it does color your story definitely. Mm-hmm. But anyway,
what do you mean by that? Color your story?
Well, I think how you see home or what your home is like,
mm-hmm.
Is going to probably affect how you see the world and how you move through the rest of your story.
Yeah.
Whether it was very hard or it was very full of joy and love, mm-hmm. or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems that that's also where your story ends, where it began.
Mm-hmm.
My mother-in-law pointed out to me at one point how many people, after they retire, return to
mm-hmm.
their beginnings.
Mm-hmm.
And I started noticing that as true.
Mm-hmm.
I tell my wife where she lives is home.
Oh, that's nice. That's true, too, isn't it?
So,
the hotel or
okay.
travel lodge.
So the place matters very little to you.
The structure is immaterial.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Wow, that's good. That's
interesting. What does it mean to have a story to you?
If you didn't have a story, you'd be pretty dull.
Okay.
I think everyone has a story, the story of their his or her life.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, whether it be a happy story, a sad story, or all around, any kind, you know, everybody has a story. Without a story, you're nothing.
Mm-hmm.
I was thinking in this, I journaled this, what's your name? I've forgotten.
Joanne.
Joanne came and sat across from me, and I was going to just bury my nose in a book because I was alone. And Joanne came and sat, and I thought, and we got started talking about the people here.
Mm-hmm.
And the minute you just sit down with someone, and an ordinary looking person becomes a story,
mm-hmm.
the minute you talk with them.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and I thought, I thought, I want to follow Joanne's example and say, you know, there's so much story there,
mm-hmm.
if you dare to just enter in.
That's an interesting point. I mean, is there a story if the story is never heard?
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Oh,
yeah.
Right. I mean, it is kind of that question. But
yeah.
So think for a minute about the act of telling your story. What does that do? What purpose does it serve? Or why? Why do we tell our story? And why do we enjoy listening to other people's stories?
I think we, most of the time, only tell our story when there's a setting of trust.
Mm-hmm. And we've certainly, it does. Okay, so telling your story produces a particular, induces a vulnerability. And we've probably all had experiences where we've told our story to someone that we wish we
hadn't.
Yes.
We were dating just a few weeks, and at some point she had been journaling something with a group somewhere, and so she presented me with her story to read.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very personal.
Mm-hmm. Wanting to be known, right? You cannot be known unless you tell your story, right?
There's a group of friends. I dropped out of college and then transferred, but still in contact with a group of friends from that first college.
Mm-hmm.
And when we get together, and they live closer to each other, so they still tell the stories,
yeah.
But I don't tell the stories, so they tell stories that I was, you know, a key player in that I don't remember anymore.
Uh-huh.
And these are still important stories for them that they tell with one another. And I don't have anyone to tell them to because there's no one from that phase of life around me.
Mm-hmm.
So you start to lose some
yeah,
of this
you
story.
Do. Yeah, and that sharing of story is interesting too, right? I have a group of college friends too who it seems like we tell the same stories every time we get together, but it's important for us to tell
mm-hmm.
those stories because that is the thing that connects us,
mm-hmm.
right? Right? Those shared experiences, those stories. Yeah.
There's also the family history thing. A few years ago, my sister and I and one of my daughters took a trip.
Mm-hmm.
And my sister and I got to reminisce.
Yeah.
And my daughter said, I never heard any of this.
Yeah.
There's a lot there that we need to share that we don't.
Yeah, because it's a preservation of time,
yeah.
right? I mean, those stories that your friends tell and that I tell with my college friends, it sort of preserves that time in your life, and your daughter's listening into stories from your past. It's a preservation of that point in time as well. Yeah.
I have a cousin who went through chemotherapy for cancer,
mm-hmm.
and during all the chemo and everything, she kind of lost her memory of everything
mm-hmm.
behind her.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've been reminding her of some of the things we used to do.
Yeah.
Like she was even in my wedding and she couldn't remember it.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to show her a movie to really clarify the fact that she really was there. But so she kind of appreciates the fact that I still can remember them and can relay them to her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that preservation of
yeah.
not just of the story, but of who she is.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Yeah. So the story that we're going to encounter today is that kind of thing, a sharing of story, and I think some of these things that you've been saying will tie into it as we read. So let me introduce you to the author of this story. Mary Austin is the author. She was born in Illinois, and as she describes in her own autobiography, she lived a rather lonely childhood. Her mother didn't appreciate her. She was a very imaginative and precocious child, and her mother found her to be kind of a nuisance. And so she spent a lot of time alone. At the age of 4, she kind of developed this imaginary friend who was also kind of a part of herself that she called I, Mary. And I, Mary became her muse for writing. That if she could sort of get into the I, Mary part of herself, that's where the writing came from. And at age 5, she says that she had a vision in a grove of trees. And she writes in her autobiography, God happened to Mary under the walnut tree.
Wow.
God happened to Mary under the walnut tree. She describes walking through the orchard near her family's farm and becoming aware of a presence and a voice, which she spent the rest of her life sort of searching for all the time, wherever she went. And she ended up living in California and other areas of the Southwest. And she says that, again, to go back to her childhood, that she felt her own oddity as an anomaly, not in the least realizing that there was growing up in the mind of thousands of young American women at that moment the notion that home, at least, shouldn't be the place of the apotheosis of its male members. So her home was very much centered on her father and her brothers, and she could not quite get in sync with that notion, and felt that she was strange for that, but realized later that she probably wasn't, that there were probably lots of women who felt that same
way. Did you tell us the
way.
State that she grew up in? I forgot.
She was born in Illinois and spent a good part of her childhood there. After she graduated from college, which took her some time to get through because she had a couple of nervous breakdowns along the way, but she moved to California with a degree in science and really approached the world as a naturalist and fell in love with California through a naturalist's eyes. What year? I can tell you if I look.
Did she know John Muir and the other important naturalists of the time?
I don't know if she did. Sorry. There in California, her brother had homesteaded there, and that's where she lived. And the first year that she moved there, it was a terrible drought, but she fell in love with the land anyway. She says that she was taken with the land as a naturalist is, about finding unexpected nourishment in the wild grapes growing in parched surroundings. And about the moment in the spring of 1889 when she went walking through a hollow and experienced again the warm, pervasive sweetness of ultimate reality. I think that's, you know, that kind of God connection again. So she began to write, and actually her first published story, which was, you know, fairly successful. She showed it to her mother, and her mother said, well, I think you could have made more of that. So a very, you know, difficult relationship with her mother. Then the family farm in Illinois was sold, and she could not convince her mother and her brother that she had the rights to some of that money. And so out of that, and out of the fact that she failed her teaching examination twice and had no way to make a living, she basically got married for economic security. And that was a difficult marriage and difficult life. Her husband moved them to Death Valley, and she wasn't very happy about that.
Oh, God.
And in that place, she wrote a collection of sketches called The Land of Little Rain. And she also gave birth to her only child there, and it was a daughter who was mentally handicapped.
Oh, no.
And she found that she was unable to care for her. So when that child was 12, she institutionalized her and really never saw her again.
What a sad life.
but she writes these beautiful, beautiful stories, which you'll see in a minute. So she left the desert in 1906 to move to Carmel in order to affiliate with other writers. And
she was single then?
Yeah, by then she was single. It was in her home that Willa Cather wrote Death Comes for the Archbishop.
Oh, wow.
So Cather stayed with Austin and wrote that novel at that time. So she had that connection. And then in the final years of her life, she worked to preserve and encourage the arts of the Pueblo Indians in New Mexico. Mm. So she had a real connection to the desert and the people of the desert and the art that they were creating and that kind of thing. So
did she support herself by her writing?
Yeah, and she was able to support herself. She did really, really well. So the story that we're going to look at today is called The Walking Woman, and scholars think that this character is kind of an extension of Austin herself. And this story appeared in a collection called Lost Borders. So I want us to think, I think that title is really provocative, Lost Borders. So I want to have us just do a little thinking about the images that that title evokes, Lost Borders. What does that make you think of?
Well, a lot of things. I'm thinking about all the land that was lost by the Native Americans,
mm-hmm.
or, you know, fights over today over boundaries and having land surveyed. Sometimes
mm-hmm.
you think your property's here and it's there, you know, that kind of thing.
Okay. So sort of elusive borders in some ways, right?
Yeah.
Can't figure out where the borders should be or, okay.
You're thinking of land, but it had mm-hmm. a lot of other implications.
Yes,
also.
Yes.
Lost identity.
Uh-huh.
If you say you have your borders of your culture, and they begin to be lost
mm-hmm.
and disseminated, you could lose your identity.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So interesting in the way that that notion of region, right, sort of bordering us and helping us figure out who we are,
mm-hmm.
right, that we are dependent in some way upon parameters and borders to say what our identity is. Yeah.
Borders sometimes can signify separation
mm-hmm.
too. So think of it on the kind of the other side.
Mm-hmm.
To lose separations
mm-hmm.
is to connect with that which is beyond the borders.
Mm-hmm.
There's an openness to it. Borders,
mm-hmm.
I'm from Montana, borders are fences.
Yeah.
You know? and fences are not necessarily a good thing. We want that wide open
mm-hmm.
feeling.
Mm-hmm.
So to have the loss of those is to have it.
Right. And the ability to move through those areas that you before could not.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
How about the migration of the
mm-hmm.
animals or birds, you know, from where there's border disputes between countries like with Mexico, and then putting up borders because, you know, for whatever, and then that interrupts the wildlife.
Yeah.
I'm thinking about their loss here. You know, there's so many people who have never been here before, but I've been hearing, you know, so many people who have been used to being able to go
around the village.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Lots of people got this
lost border. They can't go there.
Right.
Yeah.
Monkey Bear Falls is closed. My
dad. Borders.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
said,
yes.
Oh no, we were going up there, and they just put them aside. Or you can't go to the Monkey Bear Falls.
Yeah,
so
that happened
point.
To us too. Yeah. So yeah. So the what is on the other side being lost to you,
mm-hmm.
right? Hmm. Interesting. There's a scholar named Mark Simpson who has a book called Trafficking Subjects, and in it he talks about the 19th century being a time of mobility,
mm-hmm.
and that America becomes sort of defined by its citizens' ability to move.
Mm-hmm.
You know, early 19th century particularly, where America is trying to figure out who we are exactly, and how to define ourselves apart from Britain in particular, but other areas of the world as well. And his argument is that mobility becomes the way that we define ourselves as uniquely American, that we can move and travel and go to places. Of course, that was a pretty masculine construction at the time, right? For women, it was not so easy to move and go and do things. And so this character of the walking woman is interesting. See that she is on the move as her name suggests, she's walking, and crossing borders and discovering new boundaries and or lack thereof, and new ways to define her identity. So let's get to the story. Kind of sectioned off here, and I think we'll read it together and kind of talk about each section as we go. Two more.
I would love to be able to have it to take home.
Yeah. Is it everybody Gillen? Because I can run upstairs and make more coffee.
And we'll be reading it out loud, so maybe I think we'll be okay. Okay. So, to avoid my doing all the talking, is there somebody who would like to read this first section for us? Thank you.
Whether between her seldom unaccountable appearances in our quarter, she went on steadily walking, we never learned. She came and went, oftenest in the kind of muse of travel which the untrammeled space begets, or at rare intervals, flooding wordlessly with talk, never of herself, but its things she had known and seen.
Keep going, please. Up to those asterisks.
All of which should have made her worth meeting, though it was not, in fact, for such things I was wishful to meet her. And as it turned out, it was not of these things we talked when at last we came together. For one thing, she was a woman, not old, who had gone about alone in a country where the number of women is as 1 in 15. She had eaten and slept at the herders' camps, laid by for days at one-man stations whose masters had not another touch of humankind than the passing of chance prospectors. She had been set on her way by teamsters who lifted her out of the white, hot desertness and put her down at the crossing of unnamed ways, days distant from anywhere. And through all this, she passed unarmed and unoffended. I had the best testimony to this, the witness of the men themselves. I think they talked of it because they were so much surprised at it. It was not on the whole what they had expected of themselves.
Mm-hmm. So that's basically the beginning of the story. I did insert you about partway into the first paragraph, but what are your impressions so far? Any guesses as an answer to that? How did she eat?
Wherever she stopped?
I think so.
Teamsters and with the men.
Yeah. That would be my guess.
Sounds lonely.
Very.
Very lonely, but she has managed to survive with it.
Mm-hmm.
We'll have to find out more about her.
A woman out there on her own like that. That's
mm-hmm.
Well, even today would be risky.
Maybe it's more risky.
Even
more risky
today, yeah.
And yet we're told that she was unarmed and unoffended.
Yeah.
Right? And that the men are surprised at their own behavior, right? That
mm-hmm.
they haven't offended her, that they haven't,
yeah.
that they treat her with utmost respect, calling her Mrs. Walker because they don't know her name, right?
I imagine she just had a demeanor about her that
mm-hmm.
was
a no-nonsense.
That was,
yeah, that it, she just, whatever she put out there was a strong woman,
mm-hmm.
and who, yeah, it, but, and yet who would let them in, get her out of the desertness, and send her on her way again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Other thoughts? I mean, this is definitely a desert. What are sort of the connotations of desert? Some of it's hot.
Barren.
Barren.
No water.
No water.
Beautiful when it rains. This is gorgeous. You know, it's a, there's that little time when everything comes to life. The family comes to life with flowers.
Yeah. Other things you think of when you think of desert places?
Well, there's also a desert shortage of women.
Mm-hmm.
So it's 15 to 1. That means these men probably have not seen a female for
mm-hmm.
some time.
Mm-hmm.
And thus she was welcome just to have female company.
Mm-hmm. Perhaps.
The desert is also seen as a very holy, meditative kind of
mm-hmm.
place. You think of Jesus in the wilderness, and you think of a lot of things that have happened in the desert. Because it is so barren,
mm-hmm.
The desert fathers. So there can be perceived something rather holy about it.
Yeah, what is it about barrenness that evokes a sense of holiness or sacredness? What is that? What is
uncluttered.
The connection? Uncluttered, okay.
Healing up of everything that holds us to the earth,
okay.
to the needs and necessities of life, and just giving those up and kind of throwing yourself on the mercy of God or the
mm-hmm.
mercy of others or the mercy of life itself
mm-hmm.
and letting it happen. There's a sense of vulnerability but also deep trust that everything will be all right.
Which goes back to that same sense of telling your story, right? So that's what I think makes this so interesting in this story is that we have this woman who has made herself completely vulnerable and entrusted herself to the land, really, right? And it is on that land that she is sort of writing her story as she walks, right? So, so the next section of the story tells a little bit about some of the things that she's seen, right? She's witnessed a murder. She thinks, the narrator thinks or assumes that she has. She's witnessed a big snow that happened there in the desert. She's witnessed, you know, sort of all these things that make her sort of an intriguing person, right, that people want to talk to. And yet we're told in this section that wasn't why the narrator wants to meet her, and that those are not the things that they talked about when they finally did meet.
Hmm.
Right.
That's one of the things that interested me, is
mm-hmm.
that she's traveling, one, without an errand, when she has no purpose.
Mm-hmm.
She's just walking.
Yes.
We don't think like that. You always got to have a purpose.
Yes.
But two, she doesn't talk about herself.
Yes.
But only the things she sees and knows.
Yes.
She's not telling her own story to these people. She's just telling what she's seen and what she knows.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, yeah, that is one for the narrator.
Yeah. It's interesting that you said the guy for the narrator. What makes you think that the narrator is a guy?
Because of it's 1 to 15.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's all these men, and so it just seems like he is one of these men that has run into her. That's my sense,
mm-hmm.
That it would be much less likely in that scenario for it to be one. But then again.
Anybody else have a sense about the narrator?
I think if it would have been female, she would have had seen everything. It would have been written from a different perspective.
Okay.
About how stupid this woman was.
Uh-huh.
It would be more of a put down than a respect.
What do you think? You're disagreeing.
I don't necessarily agree about your question why, but
yeah. Okay.
It just seems like it could be a woman.
Well, I will tell you that Austin never really fully gives us the answer as to who the narrator is.
Mm-hmm.
And any ideas why she doesn't? Why would she sort of come back to the narrator too. I also want to pick up on a couple other things that Lori mentioned, that this idea of her walking with no discoverable errand, right? There is no, apparently no reason for her to be out there. It is
just to be
walking, just to be, which is counterintuitive to society in general, and certainly at that time when it was, you know, maybe a little prior to this, when it's all go west, young man, right? That you have to be going somewhere to achieve something or find something, or you're on a quest of some kind. And she is just walking.
Particularly for a woman.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it seems to be this third option, right, between heading west and homemaking.
Yes.
Right? It seems to be her home is the quest, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Her home is the journey.
I might steal that.
I think it's possible for a person to just wander and see what turns up.
Yeah.
What life they get. I think we do that in our own lives, not necessarily the physical walking,
mm-hmm.
of not having a direction.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think that we see ourselves as valuable human beings by what we do and by our goals and where we're going.
Yeah.
And she is finding tremendous value in this journey,
mm-hmm.
of just plain being.
Mm-hmm.
And that, as you said, it's so counterintuitive.
Yeah.
That maybe that is the understanding of grace in its biggest form, you know. Not that we all could do that.
Right.
It's not very practical, mm-hmm. but she sees value in living apart from doing.
Yeah, yeah. And that's my whole thesis, you guys. You just got it right there.
Oh.
Right, that this notion of wandering being very different from a notion of having to go somewhere with a purpose, but that there's something productive and creative that happens in the act of wandering, right? And I think this walking woman is a fantastic example of that. Well, let's move on. Who'd like to read this next couple of paragraphs here?
Well, I understand that nature, which wastes its borders with too eager burning, beyond which rim of desolation flares forever quick and white, and have had some inkling of the isolating calm of a desire too high to stoop to satisfaction. But you could not think of these things pertaining to the walking woman, and if there were any truth in the exemption from offense residing in a frame of behavior called ladylike, it should have been inoperative here. What this really means is that you get no affront so long as your behavior in the estimate of the particular audience invites none. In the estimate of the immediate audience, conduct which affords protection and Mayfair gets you no consideration or maverick. And by no canon could it be considered ladylike to go about on your own feet with a blanket and a black bag and almost no money in your purse in and about the haunts of rude and solitary men. There were other things that pointed the wish for a personal encounter with the walking woman. One of them was the contradiction of reports of her as to whether she was comely, for example. Reports said yes, and again, plain to the point of deformity. But by the distance she covered, she should have been straight and young. As to sanity, equal in certitude. Mm-hmm. On the mere evidence of her way of life, she was cracked. Not quite broken, but unserviceable. Yet in her talk, there was both wisdom and information, and the word she brought about trails and waterfalls was as reliable as an Indian.
That's about that. What's
wow.
About that.
I'm going to have to read that first paragraph twice.
That's a lot there. That's a little big.
Back to syntax.
Yeah.
Thoughts about that section.
In a frame of behavior called ladylike, it should have been inoperative.
Yes.
no consideration in manhood. And I think that's so true of different situations.
Mm-hmm.
You get respect in some ways in some situations and you wouldn't get it.
Right. And this notion of sort of civilized and uncivilized terrain, right? I mean, the desert, even still, I think, is often considered kind of uncivilized, you know, place, uncivilized topography that is wild and needs, in need of taming, right? And the Waki woman is like that.
Right? It's dangerous if you don't know where, if you don't know what you're doing in the desert. What we talked about that before.
Mm-hmm.
It's a dangerous place.
Water holes.
You gotta know where your water holes are.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And she does.
Yeah.
She does.
I like that.
Right? I mean, she is a wealth of information.
But why is she a wealth of information if she's never walked there before?
Well, because she probably
she's
walks
been walking
the same
there for a long
time. But she's been walking that same area for a long, long time.
I think it's a circuit, yeah.
Okay. All right. She's a
I would think so.
Yeah,
hmm.
That's kind of the impression we get. So she's walking in the same area.
Hmm.
But by meeting clusters of men hither and thither, she finds where, you know, they know their small area.
Yeah.
And they can lead her to the next spot.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, she survives through information.
Mm-hmm. And she becomes the vehicle to circulate the information,
yes.
Right? So there's something sort of public about the way she's behaving, right? In that there's a circulation that she is the means of.
She's Google.
Yeah, she's Google.
I mean, she's the source of information for anybody who meets her, and but she also gleans information from those that she meets and then spreads that information.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Some things it should be tamed.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Right. So the story goes on to tell us that the second paragraph here, you know, sort of gets at the narrator's curiosity, right? Why is the narrator interested in meeting this person? Yeah, why? What is eliciting the curiosity?
Well, he's wondering if there's something strange about her that he wants to discover. It's about her physical appearance or her mental, social skills,
mm-hmm.
emotional status. He's just really curious.
Mm-hmm. And the reports are contradictory.
Yeah,
isn't that
interesting? She can't be pinned down.
Right.
Some say she's calmly. It's always things.
Some say she's.
She's a mystery.
There is something, Laurie, you were going to say.
It is interesting that he or she, the narrator, mm-hmm. focuses on her appearance.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
If this was a walking man,
mm-hmm.
would that have even been important
mm-hmm.
to bring up?
Mm-hmm.
But for this narrator, the idea of is she good looking or is she plain?
Mm-hmm.
Is she nuts or is she just trying to figure out life, you know? The appearance piece is something that comes up particularly with women.
Yeah.
That is she good looking or not? Yeah.
But I wonder if it was a man who was a homemaker, right? If then they would focus on his appearance. You know, if it was not the cowboy, but the man who was.
So a man dislocated from his sort of social.
If they would describe him as being more feminine or whatnot.
Yeah,
it could be.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah. And I think that goes along with that acceptability again, that what we're expecting of a woman is this,
mm-hmm.
and she maybe is not, right? Or vice versa. So the next paragraph I'll just read for you. It says, by her own account, she had begun by walking off an illness. You don't have this on your sheet. I'm just reading to you. There had been an invalid to be taken care of for years, leaving her at last broken in body and with no recourse but her own feet to carry her out of that predicament.
Mm.
It seemed there had been, besides the death of her invalid, some other worrying affairs upon which, and the nature of her illness, she was never quite clear, so that it might very well have been an unsoundness of mind which drove her to the sobered and healed at last by the large soundness of nature.
Wow.
It must have been about that time that she lost her name. I am convinced that she never told it because she did not know it herself. She was the walking woman, and the country people called her Mrs. Walker. At the time I knew her, though she wore short hair and a man's boots and had a fine down over all her face from exposure to the weather, she was perfectly sweet and sane. So that's kind of the only explanation we get in the story as to why she is out walking. But this notion that perhaps there was something not quite right, but that nature, the soundness of nature, sobered and healed her.
That's kind of Mary Austin's story a little bit too, from a little bit
different
Elvis, isn't it?
Absolutely.
It's Forrest Gump.
It's Forrest Gump.
Yeah.
He's running.
He's running, not walking. Right. And for Mary Austin may very well be the quintessential regionalist. For her, it was very important that the land be a character in the story.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you can see that here, right? That the land is the thing that heals her. And the land is the thing with which she is in relationship, really.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
My choice would have been the here rather than the desert.
Yeah.
You gotta write your story.
And Mary Austin knows the desert, and Mary Austin loves the desert. But I think beyond that, that there's something, sort of symbolic or metaphoric about it being the desert,
mm-hmm.
right? Kind of this blank slate on which
mm-hmm.
you can write your own identity. It's interesting that she's lost her name, right? This idea that she calls herself the walking woman because she doesn't remember her name. I mean, what does that say to you about her?
It's also interesting that the story from yesterday, Hetty, lost her home because she had cared for an individual who had died.
Yeah.
That probably happened a lot to women.
I suppose so, yeah.
Well, yeah, probably did. A lot more than it does today. Although there are
stories
about
the industry and everything for women to get jobs and what have you. That was probably the only thing that they were able to do because that's what they were raised with. The home,
and someone had to be cared for as they got older.
Well, there's always the cooking and cleaning.
Traditional women's work.
Yeah,
that's right.
What was Austin's? You said she had a kind of vision of God experience.
Mm-hmm.
What was her religious? Did she know the Bible? Because there's this great line in here,
mm-hmm.
almost no money in your purse.
Mm-hmm.
And it really brings back the images of when Jesus sends out the disciples. You bring your cloak
mm-hmm.
and nothing
yeah.
else. And you rely on the kindness of the town.
Yeah.
And if they don't do you well,
you
kick off and you leave.
Right.
And it just, her walking around this desert with no money in your purse, with a blanket and a bag and nothing else, in and about the haunts of rude and solitary men, kind of brings it, those images to my mind. And so I was just wondering, is Austin kind of alluding to that image of a disciple,
mm-hmm.
Maybe not necessarily following God or Christ, but
mm-hmm.
following some other teacher or leader or something?
She does know that, and I think at that time it would be reasonable to guess that any educated person would have known the Bible.
You would think
really,
so, yeah.
You know, because that's where it often started. You know, that's where education began, was in Scripture. So I think that would be a reasonable guess. Regionalist writers are very careful, it seems to me, to not talk about God, to not talk about religion. I think in an effort to sort of, again, separate themselves from the writing that women had been doing before, which was very much about Christian didactic, instruction, to separate themselves as artists, I think they were very careful to sort of avoid at least explicit mentioning of faith in God.
Drawing out the imagery, but not tying
section says, I had met her occasionally at ranch houses and road stations and had got as much acquaintance as the place allowed. But for the things I wished to know, there wanted a time of leisure and isolation. And when the occasion came, we talked all together of other things. So here the narrator is situating us as the readers in a particular frame of mind to hear the story, right? I mean, we've heard the story that everybody else has heard about the walking woman up to this point, right?
We want to hear her story.
And now we're being situated differently. We're being taken out of the ranch houses and road stations and into a place of leisure and isolation so that we can hear about other things, which I find interesting. And that notion that in order to really listen to somebody, I know some of you have been sitting in on Janet and Ross Blank-Lieber's sessions too, where they're talking about listening, that you need space, right? And time for rest and leisure in order to really listen and hear. And so she creates that space. So would somebody like to read the top of the second page?
You are not to suppose that in my report of a borderer I give you the words only, but the full meaning of the speech. Very often the words are merely the punctuation of thought, rather the crest of the long waves of intercommunicative silences. Yet the speech of the walking woman was fuller than most. The best of our talk that day began in some dropped word of hers, from which I inferred that she had had a child. I was surprised at that, and then wonder why I should have been surprised, for it is the most natural of all experiences to have children. I said something of that purport, and also that it was one of the perquisites of living I should be least willing to do without. And that led to the walking woman saying that there were three things which if you had known, you could cut out all the rest. And they were good anyway, you got them. But best if, as in her case, they were related to and grew each one out of the others. It was while she talked that I decided that she really did have a twist to her face, a sort of natural warp or skew into which it fell when it was worn merely as a countenance, but which disappeared the moment it became the vehicle of thought or feeling. Thought about the having least willing to do without having children indicate that the
narrator is a woman.
But a man could say that.
Could. But there does seem to be some indication here that perhaps the narrator is a woman as well. Yeah. And I think in the next section you'll see some of that too. So this section really is about the sort of the art of communication, right? And what is the narrator telling us is important in order for communication to happen?
Silences.
Mm-hmm.
It says very often the words are merely the punctuation of thought,
yeah,
rather than the crest of the long ways of intercommunicative silences.
Isn't that a great line? Words are merely the punctuation of
yeah.
thought.
That's
I love
a
that.
Word.
But the silences, right? And the narrator says, I rest assured I will not give you only the words, but the full meaning of the speech, right? So that the words are only a part of it. And that the walking woman's speech was fuller than most. What does that mean, do you think? How do you imagine this conversation sounding?
With lots of silence,
mm-hmm,
and pauses. She's having to think about what she's saying.
Yeah.
Or she just naturally does so.
Mm-hmm.
It's something that our culture doesn't appreciate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we want people to get to the point now.
Yeah.
But
she's picturing things and then describing what she pictures.
Yes, and if I could have given you the whole story, you would see points where she explains something and then she grows silent and she gestures or she rocks back and forth or she does some kind of just silent movement that
twist to her face. You know, even right there you see it. She really did have a twist to her face. She makes a facial gesture.
Mm-hmm.
What do they say? 80% of our communication, 90% is actually done through our facial features and our hand movements and our body movement, and just a small percentage is done through the actual words. She's the author's obviously picking up on something that later becomes a scientific.
Yeah, right. And how interesting for a person whose craft is words, right, to recognize sort of the lesser importance of them as opposed to all the other things that go on in communication and storytelling, right? Okay, so the Walking Woman goes on to tell a story about in the process of her walking that she meets a shepherd. And he is without his assistant, who has gone on an errand into town for 3 days. And a dust storm comes up. And the flock gets dispersed.
Oh.
And so she, the walking woman, helps the shepherd bring the flock back together. And in the course of their working together and accomplishing this task together, they fall in love.
Oh,
she and the shepherd. And she says that he loves her because she did good work. She did her work well, and he recognizes that. And she loves him for recognizing that.
Right?
And so then they have a child, and the child does not survive. And she says, so she tells about the child. My baby was born in October. Whatever more there was to say to this, the walking woman's hand said it, straying with remembering gesture to her breast. There are so many ways of loving and working, but only one way of the firstborn. She added after an interval that she did not know if she would have given up her walking to keep at home and tend him, or whether the thought of her son's small feet running beside her in the trails would have driven her to the open again. The baby had not stayed long. And whenever the winds blow in the night, said the walking woman, I wake and wonder if he is well covered.
Mm-hmm.
So, what she tells the narrator is this next section. I have always said, I will say again, I do not know why at this point the walking woman touched me. If it was merely a response to my unconscious throb of sympathy, or the unpremeditated way of her heart to declare that this, after all, was the best of all indispensable experiences. Or if in some flash of forward vision encompassing the unimpassioned years, the stir, the movement of tenderness were for me. But no, as often as I have thought of it, I have thought of a different reason, but no conclusive one, why the walking woman should have put out her hand and laid it on my arm. To work together, to love together, said the walking woman, withdrawing her hand again. There you have two of the things. The other you know. The mouth at the breast, said I. The lips and the hands, said the walking woman, the little pushing hands and the small cry. There ensued a pause of fullest understanding while the land before us swam in the noon, and a dove in the oaks behind the spring began to call. A little red fox came out of the hills and lapped delicately at the pool.
Mm.
So the walking woman teaches the narrator the three most important things of life, right? To work together, to love together, and to have a child. Two of them, very feminine type things to do, right? To love and to have a baby. And yet, the walking woman's performance of these very feminine kinds of things sort of happen on her own terms, right? And in very sort of, in an open space, not a closed domestic kind of place like the home that we would usually have. So then just to finish, since we're almost out of time, she was the walking woman. That was it. She had walked off all sense of society-made values. Knowing the best when the best came to her was able to take it. Work, as I believed. Love, as the walking woman had proved it. A child, as you subscribe to it. But look you reader. It was the naked thing the walking woman grasped, not dressed and tricked out. certain occupations. And love, man love, taken as it came, not picked over and rejected if it carried no obligation of permanency. And a child, any way you get it, a child is good to have, say nature and the walking woman. To have it and not to wait upon a proper concurrence of so many decorations that the event may not come at all. At least one of us is wrong. To work and to love and to bear children, that sounds easy enough. But the way we live establishes so many things of much more importance. Far down the dim, hot valley, I could see the walking woman with her blanket and black bag over her shoulder. She had a queer, sidelong gait, as if, in fact, she had a twist all through her. Recollecting suddenly that people called her lame, I ran down to the open place below the spring where she had passed. There, in the bare, hot sand, the track of her 2 feet bore evenly and white. And that's the end of the story. Mm-hmm. What do you make of that final image of her feet in the sand?
She's more normal than most people.
Or more balanced, at least,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
Right? That there is no lameness to her walking.
And maybe white, a sense of purity.
Yeah.
About the passing of time, the footsteps will blow away.
Yeah. But her story, right, her story has been told now, and what is it about the listener that made that possible for her story to be told? Because we're told in the beginning that she doesn't talk about herself,
mm-hmm.
right? She talks about the things she has seen and experienced.
A lot of patient observation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And willingness to really listen to the whole
mm-hmm.
story, right? I love that line about her hand said it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Her hand said it. And to really listen to all of that. So I think who is listening shapes what gets told, too.
Yeah, well, what was it about this narrator
mm-hmm.
that caused her to open up in a way that she didn't open up to anybody else?
Mm-hmm.
And the narrator, he or she, doesn't really know what that is about him or herself.
No. Right. I don't know why at that moment she touched me. Was it, what was it? Was it an affinity? Was it just, you know?
Merely a response to my unconscious throb of sympathy.
Mm-hmm. And the walking woman keeps walking. Right? Even as the story ends, the walking continues.
Mm-hmm.
And the story